Clive Neeson has documented the development of extreme sport. With footage collected over 45 years, he's made a movie about it and about environmental degradation, climate change, oil dependency. Neeson was a member of what he calls a maverick brotherhood, united in a quest to find their own idea of nirvana at a time when there were no rule books and no boundaries and in a world that no longer exists. The documentary he's made is an odd mix of adrenaline and nostalgia and ingenuity, and it's called Last Paradise. As he says at the beginning of the movie, it's about the fate of the wilderness, filmed over 45 years, so we might relive the journey better, see our tracks. Clive Neeson, who's also a scientist specialised in energy development, joins me now to play favourites. Good morning. Hello. How are you? You don't mind if I call it an old mix, do you? Your movie.
Not at all. It's the whole purpose of the film is to provoke thought anyway in all ages. So if you want to call it that, that's fine.
The footage is like 70% yours, 30% other people's that you've acquired having started thinking about making the movie, right?
That's right. The footage really, the whole project started out as a massive investigation to try and find the best footage in New Zealand and partially Australia that told the story about this magnificent environment that we live in, the magnificence of New Zealand and its people too, how its people were shaped by that wilderness and ingenuity and what is ingenuity and so on. The things that we treasure in New Zealand, I tried to get into this movie.
You're so crazy, you guys, though, weren't you?
Not crazy, no. This is the connection you make in the movie between science and these sports. There was a lot of science involved. It was all calculated risk. It still is calculated risk, and there's a safety in that.
The childhood footage that you have is wonderful because it's the kind of childhood that everybody wishes that they could give their children. You had it, you guys. You were out there in the wilderness, in the country, making your own carts and stuff. Are kids able to do that now? At all?
Are they able to do that? Yes. Are they inclined to? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. You have to realise the person that filmed that 50 years ago, 55 years ago, she was an orphan from the First World War. That was my mother. She filmed all that. And she had nothing. She had a very deprived childhood, very cruel. And so what you see in this movie is what is born of nothing. And the people in this movie were not deprived. Sorry, they were not advantaged in any way. They had nothing. They had no TVs. That's why they had to go and play in the wilderness.
You had to make your own stuff.
They made it. And that was the very progenitor of the ingenuity that we talk about in the movie. Kiwi ingenuity, which has become a cliche today.
Are you saying that your mother made sure that you guys had that kind of childhood because she didn't? Was it a deliberate act?
I think that's what it was. She was already a cinematographer. But I think she was really fascinated and intrigued by what we and other kids were doing out in the bush. We would see something and say, is that possible? God, that's got to be possible. And would devise some kind of means to jump off a waterfall or to take on the wilderness. And she was involved in that. She said, oh, I've got to film this. And so that is the very same thing which today drives science forward. Is this possible? Is this development of this new kind of energy possible? It must be. Let's drive forward and do it. And that's what I'm trying to connect with this movie, is to arm the kids of the future with the very same resource.
Let us go back a little. You were brought up, for the most part, in Zambia.
It was Tanzania. Tanganyika was called then.
And your parents were wildlife photographers?
Yes, we spent most of our time on safaris in a camper van, if you like, that my father built, and lived amongst the animals a lot.
How extraordinary.
It was extraordinary. I think what was extraordinary about it was that my mother was willing to take that on and to bring kids up in a dangerous environment.
And your parents brought you to New Zealand at what age were you?
I was 8 years old.
Why did they decide to come to New Zealand?
Well, things had changed politically in Africa. So, and I think also they were filming the animals. That was their passion. That was their love. And things had changed to the point where the animal kingdom was taking a real beating from mankind, and they weren't so enamored with that, and they couldn't do anything about that. And so I guess I can remember the choice that we made in the camper van there. My parents made it, of course, about this place called New Zealand, as opposed to going, say, to Britain or back to these other colonies. And it was this amazing, amazing dream for this place with mountains and beaches. And we knew beaches in Africa, but we didn't know snowy mountains. And you could do all this amazing stuff. And even back then, somehow that word had gotten to Africa. So we pushed our father, go to this place, go to this New Zealand. And when you come from outside of New Zealand, you see what New Zealand is. And from then on, we were so enamored by it, and my parents were too, that they filmed it. And they filmed us kids playing in it and our friends playing in it. And that's really what became the starting point of the film.
Did you find New Zealand terribly tedious because it didn't have any elephants or other wild animals?
No, we were on our back foot there. My parents were on their back foot. I mean, we had sessions where we're screaming inside the van, all terrified and you know, being accosted by elephants and things bigger than us, very close range. It was very scary, and animals were everywhere. They weren't just in a national park, and that's what we see in the movie, is animals were everywhere. Now they're locked up. They're in cages, basically. So coming to New Zealand, we had this kind of relaxed feeling that we're in a place now. We're no longer threatened.
Nothing could
eat
you.
But the same, no, nothing could eat us. So just the same flies. And so here we were with this appetite almost. So it went the other way. We had this inclination to get out into the wilderness and find danger once again. And it's almost like danger became the comfort zone.
What were you, four boys?
We were three boys and three another boys. One happened.
Oh, I see.
We were baby boomers and our parents boomed, you know.
Your first track is Saffro Manzangi. Is that how you say it?
That's right.
From a 1997 album called Wise Man. As a Congolese musician, presumably, did you listen to this in Africa?
I didn't know I listened to this in Africa. But when we were leaving Africa, the same occasion I just told you about, I can remember crying because we were leaving this really neat place and I hoped this new country would be great. And there was this tune playing on the radio at the time that forever has reminded me of Africa. And when I came to make this film and required the music for Last Paradise, I went out worldwide to find the right music. And I was trying to find something that came from Eastern Africa. And out of the blue, this guy from London submitted this track to me. He said, I've seen your trailer. I'd like my music to be used in your film. And I was amazed. I listened to this music, and it was the same piece that I remember listening to, that I was searching for.
Nice.
When I left Africa. And I thought, this is going in the movie. So I played that through the part of the movie where you see Africa in its old form.
Victoria Eleison, Miaka. Saffro Manzangi, featuring King Kester Emeneya, from the 1997 album Wise Man, one of the favourites of Clive Neeson, whose movie is called Last Paradise. All right, so you came from Tanzania, or Tanganyika as it was, to Raglan. Why Raglan?
Raglan because it was the cheapest real estate probably in New Zealand at the time.
And your parents didn't have a lot of dosh.
They didn't have a lot of money, no. But I think my parents had developed a taste for what was good. You know, they loved the wilderness, and Raglan was wild. It was, as we knew it then, it was just full of mud. It was muddy harbours and so on. And it was pretty embarrassing when we finally went to another school in Hamilton to admit that you went to Raglan and you couldn't afford to go to Mount Maunganui and all these white sand beaches, you know. But what happened, of course, is that eventually as kids we went over the hill and discovered this this jewel. We followed a car over the hill. And luckily we have original footage of that, the way it was at Raglan and all that exploration.
There's some lovely footage of you guys mud surfing.
Yes, that was about the... That's what Raglan was known for, is mud surfing.
Where did all that mud, you're suggesting in the movie, I think, that it was runoff from the hills after over cultivation?
That's right, yeah. Most of our harbours in New Zealand were deep water harbours. In fact, the Narrows, which goes upward from Raglan Harbour, used to extend several kilometres, I think it was about 17 miles or 17 kilometres, deep water. And that, of course, filled in with mud. And that process is still going on to some extent. But the good news is that the locals there, particularly local surfers, have now banded together and realized that this mud is transient. It comes and goes. It ebbs with the tide to some extent. And if you stop that running into the harbors, then eventually will revert itself back to deep water harbor again. And there's some good work being done. And one of the purposes of Last Paradise is to demonstrate very easily with perhaps subliminal education mechanisms like that, all in good fun, all just in a great fun journey, and help people understand, particularly the next generation, how easily it can be fixed by letting nature grow the trees to do the work. It's just a case of getting out there and doing it, but also seeing what the cause is. And, you know, I think with documentary, the issue we have with documentary, or at least I had with documentary, was that it preached to the converted. Mm-hmm. Now, I went to see Al Gore's film. Great message, good intention.
An Inconvenient Truth.
Inconvenient Truth. And the thing was, I looked around the audience and there were these baby boomer generation who already had an interest and concern in the environment. They were already converted. What I'm trying to do with Last Paradise is to give everybody a fun journey that pulls them into the issue. And then they come out of the cinema just entertained, feeling really good about their own country, and then knowing so much and knowing it all the way through to quantum physics.
Well, and that is what you've done very well, actually, because there's an awful lot of the environmental message in the broad sense that makes people feel really bad. Really, really bad, because we're doing everything wrong and, oh, my God, you can't do this and you can't do that and the future's hopeless and it's all a great disappointment. Your movie makes you feel fabulous and excited. And by the way, you say as a PS, we have to attend to a few things.
Yeah, that is the other issue with these environmental documentaries, is that they look on the dark side, you feel depressed after it. And the solution, which we know is science, is also boring as portrayed, even in schools, unfortunately. For me, science was not boring. The whole world is saying now, we need to train scientists. We need to get the younger generation into the physical sciences. We need to re-amp our universities in that, because that is how we're going to solve the problems of the future. Now, what Last Paradise is attempting to do is to implant in young people and even adults not only awareness of the problem, but that mechanism, the same one I had as a kid at 8 years old, that gave me a mission, that fired me up and said, that's what I'm going to do with my life. And I'm fired up about it. No one's telling me this. And this is what happened when we took this film to the States. We had young kids coming up the front before ordinary citizens. A lot of them were, of course, outdoor type as well. But these kids were being cheered on because they were proclaiming that the film had motivated them to study the physical sciences. They already were, but they wanted to go all the way.
And certainly for you, science was physical, as you've already said. You know, it was what enabled you to get out there and make stuff in the first instance.
Well, it was, but that was all good fun, though. I mean, science for me was probably, it was taken to a higher level through studying physics and through, how would you say, petrochemical exploitation.
Is that what you did?
Yeah, I think I spent most of my career figuring out ways to get oil and gas out from under the sea, into the pipelines, into the refineries, through the refineries, into the pipelines, ships, and into the wings of the aeroplane. You know, all those systems, all the way from designing wave monitoring systems to stop oil platforms tipping over, to designing, say, the control system in Abu Dhabi and Dubai, which delivers the fuel from the ships into the aeroplanes.
So it's a bit rich for you, having spent your career in the fossil fuel industry, to insert bits in your movie about how we're overusing fossil fuel and it's global climate changing.
Yes, isn't it? Well, you know,
is this your confession?
It's not a confession. No, no. The people who support this movie, who send me emails, are heads of petrochemical companies. Because what we did, we were pioneering a way to satisfy the demand of the consumer, to get fuel into their tanks. Now we're paving a way to get away from that. While everyone's consuming, there are scientists who are trying to work hard to find the next generation of energy. They have a real problem, and you see that problem in Last Paradise film. They declare that their main issue is political will, foremost, because politicians are reluctant to back a project which doesn't deliver fruit in their term of service.
We will get to that.
Yes.
And it's called it's hot fusion.
Sorry?
It's hot fusion hot you're talking fusion. About, right. Which has a certain frisson of eccentricity about it. But we will talk about that a little later.
Okay.
Want another track? This features in your movie as well, Cat Stevens' Peace Train. Obviously, you listened to that at the time, did you?
Yes, yes, that's right. I think everyone can remember the first time they heard Peace Train.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately.
Cat Stevens' Peace Train from, of course, Teaser and the Firecat, 1971. I'm talking to Clive Neeson. Who was Mickey Dora?
Mickey Dora was the reluctant hero, I suppose, or the icon in America who started the Gidget scene.
Mm.
Well, he didn't. Hollywood did. So they pretty much chased him out of there. And
Malibu.
From Malibu, that's right. From Malibu. He lived in Hollywood. But he was one of the guys that discovered Malibu and one of the first surfers in California. And it was an interesting story because of the connection with New Zealand. And what happened was that he decided he had had enough of all this commercialization that was chasing the sport of surfing. He saw it coming from a sport that was simply a relationship with a person in the wilderness to something that was about money. And he had enough. And he disappeared. And California was, there were millions of surfers by then. They basically lost their main man, and they wondered where he went to, and no one could find out where he went to. And we found out because he basically explored all the paradises of the world, and then he found Raglan, and he settled in Raglan at the time when we'd just discovered surf there a few years before. And so Mickey Dora, to us, was the window into the American world, but he was also the inspiration for me and my own brother and our friends to head out with a camera and a backpack and go and find paradise. And so we took these cameras out and we filmed as we went. And I suppose in a way we were first footing into countries before tourism.
Did you know that? I mean, did you have an idea?
We had an idea because he told us.
That unless you got it on the record, it would never be that way again.
Yes, I think Mickey Dora had told us that plainly. Mm. He came round and he saw some of my early footage and he said, you know what you want to do? You want to go out to these places and film it now because one day, and it won't be far away, they won't even look like that. I can see what's coming. And so that's exactly what I did.
So you went to places like, there was a tiny fishing village that you talk about in Mexico, Petacalco?
Yes.
What was that like in the 70s when you were there?
It was a quaint little fishing village where everybody just went fishing in the morning and siestaed in the afternoon and lots of music playing. And there was nothing there but a tiny little village, and we had to find a bus to get there, a little village bus. And we were looking for the world's biggest wave, the most powerful, biggest wave in the world. And we figured by looking at the coastline, it had to be there, or had to be something around there. And so we went there, and about a few kilometers walked down the coastline, there it was. Now, and it was a magic place. It was a really magic place. Now it's just a mega city of polluting steel mills and harbors, and it just became ruined. And the surf break doesn't even work anymore. Now all the villages there, all the people there, would have a thriving, sustainable business now if they could still have preserved the surf break that was there. Because very shortly after that, just amongst the surfing community, it came very famous, and then that was it. It disappeared.
So what are you blaming for the development and uglification? I was going to say destruction, but uglification will do in the broader sense of all these places. Are you blaming, you know, the global economy or capitalism? Are you blaming tourism?
There is no blame in Last Paradise. There's just awareness. It's creating the boundary conditions for the next generation. We know, we need to know where we started. We need to know what it was like on this planet 40 years ago.
But that's not where we started. what you're saying is that...
We need a wider vision.
Well, what you're saying is that we get used to, and you do say it specifically in the movie, we get used to what we have, and then we respond to the loss of what we have. You're trying to make our memories longer. Or our children's memories longer, going further back.
Yeah, we want to give them vision back in the past. As they said, Professor Green said in the States in one of our Q&As after the screenings over there, he said, what this movie shows is the changing baselines. It's a phenomenon that was coined about 10 years ago, shifting baselines. That is, what we consider in one generation to be the norm is totally different from what it was in the next generation.
Yeah.
So bit by bit, we lose sight of the way the planet is meant to be, the natural form. And it's not the change, it's the rate of change. It's what we call the delta function in physics. Mm. It's the rate of change of this progression. When you know the starting point, you know where you are, you can interpolate and then extrapolate, and you know where you're going. And if every citizen gets a clear picture of where we're going, then the vote will be different, the vision will be different, the daily activity will be different. And Last Paradise is a fun way of conveying that to them. They just go on a journey, get lost in a fun journey. They come out with that vision. That was the intent right from the beginning, to give them that span of vision.
What brought you back to New Zealand at the end, you know, when you're going out there and taking movies and going to perfect wave beaches? What brought you back to New Zealand in the end?
Oh, I think like any Kiwi... homesickness. opportunity as well. I think life has seasons, and that was the season for me of exploration. And there's a time in everyone's life, and all Kiwis know it, this is the big OE, where you go out and you learn about the world, and you say, now what can I do in the world? And you come back to New Zealand, you dust yourself off, and you go out and do it. Well, for us, our big OE wasn't necessarily going to London. It was, well, we did actually get some money for the next stage, but it was going out and probing into these parts of the world that Westerners hadn't been and taking a camera. That was our mission. But you do tire after a while of doing that, and you've got to get on with life. You've got to set yourself up in a career and so on. I had to do that.
One of the most spectacular pieces of footage, of course, will be familiar to people, I think, who's seen Off the Edge. Is that where that Tasman Glacier footage came from?
That's right.
Which was the Mike Firth movie that came out in 1974 and reminds us, you know, skiing Tasman Glacier and then hang gliding, Jeff Campbell hang gliding over Tasman Glacier. And I think that this piece of music is over that, is it not? This is Bryce Wastney and Arlie Cook, Surf the Sky.
That's right, yes.
Bryce Wastney and Arlie Cook, Surf the Sky, from the soundtrack to Last Paradise, the movie made by Clive Neeson. So Bryce Wastney, did he compose? He composed a few tracks for your movie, did he?
That's right, yeah. To get the music for the film, I basically went out over the internet, and I was in Australia at the time, Western Australia, working over there, and I applied right around the world, for, as you saw, even to the Africa, for music submissions on the basis of a trailer that was pre-made. And this guy submitted music that came in. It was just magnificent. And I assumed he was from London for some reason. And then I found he's from New Zealand. And then I found he was from right in my own hometown. I couldn't believe it. Bryce Wastney. Mm. And he basically got his skills, like many good musicians, from the piano and learned how to compose there and then went into guitar. So we actually used quite a bit of Bryce's music. And this particular track that you heard there, it extends that concept in the film, I think, that started from the maverick beginnings of surfing, going out there and saying, is that possible? Let's do it. And when Mike Firth and his team filmed the Tasman Glacier, it was really continuing that journey of saying, how can we get out there and take this same concept to the skies and hang glide the glacier? And so if you're trying to make a film whereby you want to grab all the best footage of adventure in New Zealand, you cannot go past Off the Edge.
No. Some of this footage, of course, must have been particularly hard to come by for you and for others. What was the hardest shots that you took?
The hardest shots, I think, were
some
trying
of those
to,
surf shots were amazing.
Yes, trying to get a perspective. The problem with most surf films, I find, is that they shot them from the beach. They're shot from the perspective of the surfer and not the audience. In Last Paradise, in all the sports footage, the audience is the participant. always shot from that angle. I did that right from the beginning to give my mother a taste of what it was really like, because she had missed out and she wanted to know. So I said, okay, I'm going to film it like you were there. And even in the opening scene of the movie, that's what you see, isn't it? All the way through. When it comes to trying to create a perspective of the audience with big waves, with giant waves, that is very high risk and it's not very enjoyable. Because although when you're surfing those waves, you can paddle out the channel, when you're filming them, you need to keep rolling the camera all the way through until you've basically been engulfed by the wave itself. Otherwise, it's a short shot and you can't use it. And that's a scary bit. You're throwing it to the wind, basically. Mm. And on the big waves, it's a terrible consequence. I did not enjoy that. And there's always the risk of your camera. I lost two cameras doing that.
No, expensive.
So there's a point where you get carried so deep down in the water, you realize that it's going to be you or the camera. And you let the camera go and just do those big strokes to the top. And you can't do that holding a heavy camera.
No.
And there have to be big cameras to get the clear shot. Big glass. It's not about how many pixels. It's about big glass.
Mm-hmm. Professor Bruce Lilley wanted a new vision of energy, a new energy source. And he was a proponent of hot fusion. You studied under him. You went on to study science under him. He used to go out and watch you guys surfing, didn't he?
That's right. I met him very early days at Raglan when I was surfing alone with my brother.
So what is hot fusion?
Hot fusion is basically the source of almost all the energy on this planet, and this is what is happening on the sun. Mm-hmm. When we look at the sun, we're looking at a hot fusion reaction, which is occurring at 10 million degrees Celsius.
10 million?
10 million.
Right. Mm.
To do that on Earth, because we don't have the pressures on the sun, although we achieve significantly high pressures inside the tokamak machine, we need 100 million degrees Celsius.
What's the tokamak machine?
Tokamak machine, well, first in the Western world, was actually designed and built by Bruce Lilley. And that is a machine which is like a toroidal donut shape, which contains plasma. Plasma is 99% of the universe. And that's the fourth state of matter. We have solid, liquid, gas, and we have plasma around about that 100 million degrees Celsius. That's plasma.
Where do you get plasma from?
Nowhere on this planet has plasma. Only we need to make plasma.
How do you make plasma?
You contain matter inside a
machine.
What
matter?
Oh, matter. In this case, the matter would be deuterium. To produce net energy, enormous amount, would be deuterium, which is an isotope of hydrogen derived from simple seawater.
Right.
Enormous energy release, such that a test tube of deuterium, which we can simply centrifuge from seawater, would be equivalent of a football field full of coal.
Now, given the promise of hot fusion and the verve of its proponents, why aren't we further along in producing masses of cheap energy as a consequence of it?
Well, we are further along because initially, for years, it's been 40 years away. Now it's 30 years away, because what's happened is that through the progress of the jet tokamak, of whom the leader...
Where is this tokamak?
The jet tokamak, joint European tokamak, is in England. But the new one, which will break new ground, is in France.
This is called the ITER project.
The ITER project, of which 60% of the world is involved. So Russia, China, America, Japan, and so on.
Why do you think so many scientists are so sceptical of hot fusion?
Are scientists sceptical? Not so sure.
I am.
I speak to the ones who are
involved. I am sure.
Okay, Kim. I speak to the guys who are leading the project. I speak to in Last Paradise film, the guy who you see talking there is the head of the jet tokamak, and he is the senior designer in the ITER project. I mean, who is more qualified to talk about the realism of creating fusion, and he states it on the movie, the realistic chance. Yeah. But as I mentioned earlier, he has a problem, because it's not only the political will, but it's also the next generation is not inclined to study the physical science. And investing in science has become a real concern for most countries. But it is not buying more fiber optic cable. It is not buying more powerful computers. The mathematics and the physics that is used for pioneering the next source of energy could be done on the back of a cigarette packet if we had more smokers. But it could be done, and it is done, on pencil and paper. It's advanced calculus, it's advanced algebra, and it's advanced classical physics, and in particular plasma physics. There are very few people studying that, and very few studying it to the level that it was studied 50 years ago. We've lost a whole generation of expertise. And so this is, I believe, if I'm allowed an opinion, I believe this, sorry, as a scientist, I'm just playing on you here. I believe that our single most chance for saving our civilization is the innovation of a new form of energy such as hot fusion. And we're just beginning. And now we're
all
at
right.
the front end.
Let me ask you what the difficulties are with hot fusion then. What's held it up?
Well, I think we've already touched on the fact that...
Not enough people doing it.
The political will comes about from the fact that if you've got a 30-year project, what government or what politician is want to back something that doesn't deliver fruit in their time of office? And this is something which everyone in the industry...
No, but there are plenty of things backed that doesn't offer, you know, fruit in the office. I mean, look at the CERN project. There are plenty of major scientific projects that are up and working on that don't offer immediate returns. Why hasn't hot fusion been one of those earlier on?
I think because we weren't aware. I was aware because I was involved in it and the people around me are involved in it. But I'm not sure. So few people are actually aware that this project, the largest project in the history of mankind, is actually on track. That it's actually being done.
And on just that track. On track to do what?
To produce a successful, sustained long burn of fusion energy. So the ITER project is intended to deliver 0.5 megawatt of electricity. Now that's quite significant. We're talking, so I'm sorry, gigawatt, 0.5 gigawatt. So we're not talking megawatts. It's not puny at all. The only drawback of fusion energy is because it produces so much energy that we actually have to find a big city for it to power. But if we can power big cities with the likes of fusion energy, that leaves lots of gasoline for us to be able to use for other purposes. And fossil fuels, we can minimize them and we can use them for where we really need them, not electricity.
Sounds like a plan to me, Clive. next track, Phoenix Foundation, Buffalo. This is not in your movie. This is... from an album released last year, is it not? It's not in your movie, is it?
No, it's not in my movie. No, but I think...
Phoenix Foundation are lovely.
Yes, they are. They seem to capture that that thing which that used to be in movies a lot, in music a lot in the 70s, is melody. And
me a good explanation of why there was more melody around in the 70s. What was that?
Melody? Well, a lot of the stuff you heard was on the beach of transistor radio. We had the 6-transistor radio, and it was always squawky, and there's no appeal at all in the sound from that. The electronics was poor, so melody had to rule. And so when you heard a song on the radio, it was something you could go away and sing in your own head. And I think that's what gave melody the importance in music. And now that electronics has become so clear and so sophisticated... We don't need melody anymore, so we can entertain ourselves with the sound alone.
Here's some melody from Phoenix Foundation. Phoenix Foundation, Buffalo. One of the favourites of Clive Neeson, whose movie is called Last Paradise. It was a huge hit at last year's New Zealand Film Festival. It's now being released generally. And Clive, internationally, it's going all over the show, isn't it?
Yes, I'm not ready for an international tour, but when it premiered in the States, certain professors saw it there, and they keep inviting me back there to do screenings and to talk after it, to lecture after it. So it's a really great initiator for discussion. And so I hope to be able to honour those invitations in the future, but it does sort of bleed your funds a little bit to go over to the States and take this great Kiwi story, an image of our country, and I suppose inspire Americans and inspire the world, using the Kiwi story of ingenuity and the beautiful country to inspire the rest of the world into innovation and
might just inspire them. It might just inspire them to burn more fossil fuels and come here tonight and clutter up the place.
We won't be doing that.
Does it
that
occur to you? Is this not an ironical comment?
It's about innovation of something different from that. Okay, it's not about perpetuating consumerism or perpetuating the same. It's about pioneering, as you see all through the movie of Last Paradise. It's about pioneering, giving hope that we are the forefront of pioneering another form of energy and another way of doing things.
Yeah, that's one of the messages. But another message is come to New Zealand because it's fabulous.
I'm not here to sell New Zealand. That's not my job. That may be other people's job. It's not my job. Okay, the movie happens to portray the best of New Zealand and our ethos, but that is not my intention. My intention is to inspire people to study the physical sciences and the next generation to pioneer a replacement for fossil fuels and protection of the wilderness. Because, as you know, as concluded in the film, the protectors of tomorrow's wilderness are the kids who play in it today. The characters like A.J. Hackett in the movie are doing that now, and they're an ambassadors of this new way of doing things.
Mm. Do you think there's a particularly New Zealand way of looking at things?
Oh, absolutely, and that comes from the particularly unusual country we live in.
Unusual because of its lack of...
Well, in the past, it's physical geography and the fact that we have to make do and the fact that we're always on our back foot and we have to face the world as a sort of a smaller nation. And that's great, and we want to perpetuate that because that's a great problem-solving resource.
You still surfing?
Yes, yes, still there.
Yes, yes.
Yes, well, I mean, it's good therapy.
Nice to talk to you, Clive Neeson, whose movie, as I said, is called Last Paradise, not Lost Paradise, which I keep on wanting to change the vowel in the middle. It's not lost, he says. He's way more positive than that. Last Paradise. And it is on general release very, very shortly around the country, starting, I think, with Wellington.